So, good evening, everybody. Let's start off with our motivation. And so our mind, as we know it now, is pretty much out of our control. It has all sorts of thoughts in it that we don't have the motivation to think, but that come up and disturb the peace of our mind. And often not even recognizing these thoughts when they come up, then we follow them and they get us involved in all sorts of actions and sometimes very messy situations. And then to deal with the messy situations, we have to do more actions that aren't so great. We lie, or we deceive, or we talk badly about somebody, or whatever. And so, by not being aware of our thoughts, then these thoughts just lead us here and lead us there and get us involved in quite a mess that leads to more mess. That leads to more mess. And so samsara just continues on in that way. So until and unless we have a strong determination to work with our own mind, this situation isn't going to change. In other words, nobody or no situation from the outside is going to free our mind from all these thoughts, all these emotions, all these impulsive actions. Only we can do that ourselves. So we have to have a strong motivation to do that. And so seeing that the problem that this current situation creates for us right now can be one motivation. But expanding that and seeing that everybody else is in this same situation, completely tormented by all their berserky thoughts, not being able to differentiate virtue from non-virtue, constantly creating the causes for misery, then if we think of the kindness of these beings and what they've done for us, some compassion will arise, some empathy knowing that they're like us, some compassion wanting them to be free of suffering. And then based on that, generating the bodhicitta and the aspiration for a full awakening, knowing that if we're going to do something about our own and others' situations in a lasting, substantial way, then we have to really purify our mind of all defilements and generate all of our good qualities, becoming a fully awakened one. And so we generate that motivation. And even though the motivation is quite extensive, we have to start with where we're at right now, which is looking and learning to evaluate what is going on in our mind now, and being able to discern what is virtue, what is non-virtue, what to practice and what to abandon. And so to learn how to do that, we're going to talk about the seven ways of cognizing. Or maybe better to call it seven types of cognition. So have you noticed that? That all these thoughts just come in your mind and you act on them like this? Yeah. In one of the interviews this week, somebody commented on that. You know, a thought comes and then immediately kind of act on it. And to the extent that we hardly even know the thought's there until sometime down the line, when we look at the situation we've gotten ourselves into and then say, how did I get here? Yeah. So we tend to be quite impulsive. You know, a thought enters our mind and then immediately we act on it without evaluating the content of that thought or the type of thought it is. A thought comes in, oh, I want to do this, we do it. Yeah? A thought comes, I don't like this, immediately we get in somebody's face about it. So very impulsive. Isn't that what impulsive means? A thought comes in your mind and then there you are, acting it out. And then after a while we go, how did I get in this situation? You know? Yeah? You ever had that happen?
About 10 times we do.
You know? And so sometimes it's just small situations. Like, you know, just a jam where, you know, oh, I told somebody this, and it actually wasn't 100% true, but so now I have to cover it up. So those kinds of situations on a daily basis, or sometimes those impulsive thoughts lead us to make major life decisions, yeah, that influence this life years and years and years in advance, as well as influence the kind of karma we're going to create because we put ourselves in certain, you know, situations. So, you know, when you, who was it? You said that when Zopa Rinpoche was talking in South India that he kept saying, we're in grave danger every moment, we're in grave danger. So I think this is what Rinpoche was talking about, you know? Just our tendency to follow these thoughts without stopping and evaluating. So these thoughts are going to come because of past habit, past familiarity, you know, because we've just thought them a lot and we've never bothered to counteract them and we've never bothered to do anything but basically follow them. So it's going to be tough at first. But when we see that it really puts us in situations of grave danger, then that will make us stop and really think, okay, you know, here was a thought that came in my mind to do this. Where's that thought? That thought's going to lead to that action. Where's that action going to take me? What kind of situation am I getting myself in? And by doing this, am I going to wind up in a bigger mess simply by following everything I think? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I really have to slow down and look at this stuff. And also when we see ourselves, you know, going down a wrong path mentally, and covering up for things and rationalizing things. Because we know when we're doing this, kind of, don't we? You know, there's a certain feeling in the mind when somebody says, why did you do this? And you say something. And when you're not completely being honest about it, there's a certain feeling in the mind. You know, the reason what I say sounds good and it's enough to kind of get me off the hook, but it's not totally 100% accurate. And the other person may know that and not call us on it. Yeah. But the more important thing is in our own feeling, you know. Like, and then that just kind of leads to more and more kind of rationalization and justification and excuses and we make very bad decisions in that kind of state. Yeah? So, in the 37 verses, when he says, you know, at every moment, ask ourselves, what's the state of my mind? You know, this is what he's getting at. And not just to, you know, see what state of mind I'm in, we're in, but to evaluate it. Is this something to practice or something to ban it? And then act on that. So, when you think that since beginningless time, we've just been letting our berserky mind run the show, yeah? I mean, then you think, like, that we've been born everywhere and done everything in samsara countless times, you know? Not only the upper realms, but lots of times in the lower realms. Now then it gets kind of scary. Don't you think? Yeah. So, learning about Lohrig, mind and awareness, is a topic I think that's very helpful to give us some tools to look at our mind. And, you know, one part of the Lohrig is these various types of cognizers, and another part is talking about mind and mental factors, the different kind of mental factors that we have. So there's various ways to look at the mind, but they're all really quite helpful for implementing in an attempt to understand our own mind. I must say that, as I view these things, they are guidelines to help us learn about our mind. I've been studying these things for a long time. There's many things in them that I don't understand, that don't make sense to me. So I just try to use it in whatever way seems beneficial and not get stuck on trying to squeeze every experience I have into one of these frameworks. Okay? So some people, one of your questions was, you know, and you had commented on it too, about so many, we can have all of our senses having direct, valid cognizers at the time, and each of those senses have a mental factor of feeling and discrimination, and so, you know, can I be aware of all those things at one time? And, you know, you get quite confused. When we look at our experience, yeah, we can see that, yeah, we can hear things and see things at the same time. But when we're looking at something, we may still hear it and have a direct cognizer and be able to identify it, but our attention was more on what we're seeing. And other times we may see something and it may still be a valid cognizer, but we're more paying more attention to the conversation we're having. Yeah? So instead of kind of looking at these categories and trying to shove everything in them, kind of look at your experience and what's happening. I mean, are you aware of each one of your senses functioning at the same time, plus each feeling you're having with each sense and each discrimination of each sense at the same time? Is that even a desirable state?
Not right at the moment.
Yeah? No. Okay. you know, why are we practicing mindfulness and introspective awareness? It's to gain concentration. Concentration's on one object. We want to gain concentration so that we can go deeply into the nature of reality and free ourselves from the wrong grasping. Yeah. So, you know, you don't want to get hung up with, okay, let's see, I'm seeing the, you know, the white of the wall, and what's the feeling? What am I hearing? What's the feeling? What's the discrimination? They're all going on at the same time. I don't really think they're all happening at exactly the same time, you know? And especially when you consider that it takes a few moments for us to actually cognize an object. It's not in a split second. You know, there's a time period that's going on. And even though there's a mental factor of feeling in the very first split second, you know, I wonder how extensive, what kind of quality that mental factor of feeling is in the very first split second. Because it seems to me that you have to cognize the object for a feeling of some sort to kind of arise in your mind. Yeah, and so just say, okay, there's the mental factor feeling, but, you know, it's going to take some time to actually build. Yeah, then there's a mental factor of intention with every cognizer. But, and what's strange about it is they say that, you know, all these mental factors have the same object. Well, if the object, you know, I'm seeing the white wall, and if the object is the white wall, and my mental factor of intention is the white wall, is focusing on the white wall, then how am I ever going to shift to another object? Don't I have to have an intention to turn my head or to look at something else? Yeah. So how can all these intentions, you know, how can the intention have this, always have the same object as that particular thought that you're thinking, or that particular consciousness? Yeah. So I think there has to be, I've never succeeded in being able to get answers to these questions. I've tried asking them. These are questions maybe that Tibetans don't ask. I'm not sure. But anyway, I haven't been successful in finding answers to them. So I just look at this kind of thing as, okay, you know, here's a framework that's useful for me for understanding my mind. And as my meditation deepens, then I'll be able to tell for myself how these things work. Yeah, without getting really hooked on how am I going to squeeze this all together. Are you getting what I mean? Okay. So in the same way, you know, do these seven types of cognizers cover all mental states? The way one thing in the text is worded, it sounds like they should. But when you think, okay, what is love? What mental state is love? Yeah. And, I mean, you can't really put it in any of the seven, can you? And then you think, well, you know, they talk about different kinds of meditation. And one kind of meditation is where you're trying to understand an object. So your object might be subtle impermanence, it might be the nature of dukkha, it might be emptiness. So you're trying to understand that object. And there, some of these seven cognizers, we'll get into that, can give us some progression on how to understand that object. So that's one kind of meditation we do, trying to gain clarity on an object of meditation. Another kind of meditation we do is where we're trying to transform our mind into a certain mental state. So when we meditate on equanimity or love or compassion, we're trying to transform our minds into those mental states. We're not trying to understand an object through an inference. We're trying to transform, you know, the nature of our mind into a certain, you know, emotion or a certain way of relating to something. Yeah? So it seems to me when you're doing that kind of meditation or you have those kind of mental states, it's not necessarily going to fit into the schema of the seven, you know, unless you put all of them into correct assumers, you know. But it sounds strange to say that, you know, great compassion in the mind of an ordinary being is a correct assumer. Yeah? It doesn't kind of fit into even the categories. We're going to get into that of it, you know, and it's certainly not a wrong cognizer. So, you know, it's not an inference. It's not a direct perceiver. It's not doubt. Yeah? It's not inattentive. Okay? So, just something to think about. Okay? So, like, one person asked a very good question, you know, when you're noticing, oh, I have faith in my mind, you know, well, first of all, what kind of mental state is faith? And second of all, what mental state is it knowing that I have faith in my mind? Yeah? I mean, faith, can you might have, let's say, a correct inference or correct assumption, let's say, about the effectiveness of meditation or the qualities of the Buddha, some kind of correct understanding about those objects, and as a result, faith and trust and confidence in the path arise in you. But the faith and trust and confidence aren't the inference. Yeah, there's something else. And I've always found it very strange in these seven cognizers that they don't talk very much about cognizing our own internal experiences. Yeah, so when you say, oh, I have faith, well, when you're thinking, I have faith, that's a conceptual consciousness. Yeah? Is it, maybe you could throw it in the category of correct assumer? Yeah? But how would you even, you know, make an inference? This mental state is faith because it, you know, has the qualities of faith, and then you give the definition of faith. Maybe you could do it like that. Yeah. But on the other hand, when you're meditating and you're not sitting there thinking about it, you observe there's the mental state of faith and you're just kind of experiencing that, then, you know, that's the experience of faith. And then if you notice you're experiencing faith, does that necessarily have to be a conceptual cognizer? Can't it be some kind of mental direct perceiver that's knowing our own internal things? But it certainly, that kind of mental direct perceiver doesn't fall into any of these categories here. Yeah. So in the Prasangika, as far as I can get in terms of dealing with that, is they say that feeling, you know, here, usually in low rig, feeling is the actual feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. In Prasangika, they tend to divide it in feeling can be the agent, the person, or it could be the action, or it could be what's felt. And they say that it's the action of feeling is actually feeling. Yeah. So if the action of feeling is feeling, and then pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral is what is felt. Yeah. So then they look at it that way. In that case, feeling might be some kind of mental cognizer, a mental direct perceiver. But then, you know, you can't really separate the action of feeling from the thing that's being, from the feeling that's being felt, can you? Yeah? So these are just things, I think, you know, that's what I mean. Use them as tools and just explore these things and see what you come up with. Hmm? Okay, there was another question that you had about, about the three kinds of you know, the observed object condition, the uncommon empowering condition, and the immediately perceiving condition, immediate
preceding
condition. Okay? So, and saying, well, you always say that, you know, it seems like the consciousness is there and the object's there and they bump into each other, but it's not really that way. Okay? Well, when we talk about these three conditions, we're talking about the dependent arising of consciousness in terms of causal dependence. That to have a, let's say, a sense cognizer, you need an object that's casting, you know, its aspect. Yeah, you need an uncommon empowering condition, some kind of sense power, and you need a moment of clarity and awareness before that. And all of those things are causes, and then the result is, let's say, the eye consciousness apprehending purple. Okay? So that's talking about the arising of that eye consciousness from in this sense of causal dependence. Okay? And that has nothing to do with it. I mean, that's just talking about causal dependence. Okay? When we say that the object and a valid object and a valid subject, or a reliable object, a reliable subject, are established in relationship to each other, that's talking about mutual dependence. So there, it's not that one causes the other. It's that they're dependent upon each other. So you're positing things in dependence upon each other. So here, you would be positing the object of chartreuse and the mind, the eye consciousness apprehending chartreuse. You know, you would be positing them in relationship to each other. Even though that object was, the chartreuse was the observed object condition that caused that consciousness to come into existence. Okay? So when you're positing things, it's a different type of dependent arising. Yeah, it doesn't contradict causal dependence, but don't get them all mixed up in your mind. Okay? So in the same way, when we say things are exist by being merely labeled, it's kind of, you know, is merely labeling something a cause of a phenomena? That's no. Yeah. On the other hand, that phenomena can't really exist what it is if it's not merely labeled. Okay. And then if you start getting into, well, whose mind is labeling it, then, you know, and you want to find some, you know, God's mind, so there's an absolute authority or something. I don't know, but, you know, all these are things to really think about and mull over. Okay? Was there a question from...
So it's a comment from Jonathan.
Uh-huh.
We were explaining about the certain type of cognization, something's not fit into it.
Uh-huh.
He says, when I asked what cognizes mental factors before, you said it was our perceptions. Is that not so far?
Yeah. Okay. So, our perception doesn't cognize just the mental factors. Okay, if we talk from a Satantrika viewpoint, because a mental state is you have the primary mind plus the assembly of mental factors that surround it. Apperception apprehends the mental state. Okay? However, the Prasangikas say apperception does not exist. Yeah. I mean, you can see in some ways, apperception would in some ways take care of a lot of stuff. It's like, okay, there was some mind that is a valid mind, but it's kind of inattentive, but it can, you know, and it's not the one that induces memory of the object, it's the one that induces memory of my having that mental state. Yeah. But then if you start saying, but then how do you establish that apperception? Then you have to have an apperception of the apperception. And an apperception of the apperception of the apperception. And it gets quite confusing. Yeah? And apperception is non-dual with what it's apprehending. So how can apperception can't be the one that later says, I saw this, because I saw this is dual. Okay? So, you know, there's some difficulties with apperception too. Okay. Then I just wanted to cover briefly, you know, because we got into this whole discussion before of when you see something, you know, when I see this, am I seeing light blue or am I seeing the carpet? Mm. You know? So I found some things. It's kind of interesting. But again, it doesn't totally clarify it. So there's something called a prime sense direct perceiver of a familiar object. So the example is a sense direct perceiver of a child apprehending their parents' form, their parents' body. Okay? And so, you know, it's of a familiar object. And so, you know, you see that body, you're seeing the color, the shape, and those things, but it's very familiar, and you don't need any other consciousness to help you know that that's your parent, you know, or your parent's body. Then there's another example called an initial direct perceiver. Okay, so here, it's a sense, let's say it's an eye consciousness, apprehending the color of an Utpala flower. Okay? So let's say there's a blue Utpala flower. So you're apprehending the color of the blue Utpala flower. But if you don't know what an Utpala flower is, when you see that blue, are you apprehending the blue of an Utpala flower? Or are you apprehending the blue of a flower, because you know what a flower is? Okay? So you, in that kind of case, you need somebody else to tell you, oh, that's called an Utpala flower. You know, because this was your first time seeing it, so you just saw the color blue. You know what a flower is, so you saw the blue of a flower. Okay? But you need somebody to teach you, oh, that's an Utpala flower. Then you're, oh, yeah. Okay. Then I'm seeing the blue of an Utpala flower. It's kind of like you may meet somebody, and, oh, they're a very nice person, hi and bye. And then later on somebody tells you, oh, that was so-and-so that you met. Yeah? And it's like, oh, you mean I... If somebody said, let's say, you know, did you meet Harry? You may have met Harry because you may have bumped into him in town and started talking to him, but you didn't know that that was Harry. So if somebody says, did you meet him? You say no. But on the other hand, you did meet him because he was Harry. Yeah? But you don't know that. So, you know, you need some more information before you can say, oh, I met Harry. Until then, it's I met a person. Okay? So it seems like when you know what an object is, and you know the name for it, then you can, you know, and it's a familiar object, then you can not only see, let's say, the color of it, but you can see, you know that object. But there's many cognizers, it seems like, where we see something, but we really need more information to apprehend what it is. You know, for example, you know, you're driving on the highway and you see some kind of shimmering. So you might have a reliable eye cognizer of the color of the shimmering, but you don't know if it's water or a mirage. Yeah? So you need some more information. There's a valid, you know, a reliable cognizer regarding the color of that, but not necessarily regarding the object that it is. Yeah?
But then you also don't need, like, a label for it to function. Because, like, for example, like, when we see, like, our eyes moving all the time, and then out of everything it kind of makes a shape. But for example, a kid does not even have the eyesight developed, so the kid would just feel the love of the parent. And it would know, like, to get close to it or to get close to mom.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't have any label or concept or anything yet. He knows it's his mom because of the love.
You know, we actually, labeling and concept is much more subtle than what we think of it as. So in the case of a baby, or even in the case of the kitties, are either of them up here? Okay. They're behaving? Yes, my sweetie. She hasn't come sat up here for a while. But, you know, they identify things and they have concept. You know, they don't have the language like we do, but there's definitely some conceptual ability. Yeah, and I think the same thing with a baby. There's conceptual ability, even though there's not gross language.
I think that fits with the thing that I was thinking about during this, because I've recognized many plants, flowers, wildflowers,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know the name of them, and I never have learned the name of them. I never even bothered. But,
right.
But so I have labeled them without a word,
mm-hmm.
which I think is what you're pointing to.
Right. And you can discriminate things.
Yeah, I can discriminate
even before.
I recognize them every year when I go hiking.
Yeah, right. You know, and an animal can tell what's food and what's not food.
So labeling is much more than naming.
Yeah, it's involved with naming, but it's much, much more subtle. Because all sentient beings have it. It's not just, you know, gross language.
I remember being a baby in my crib,
mm-hmm.
and I heard somebody coming, and I said to myself, here's the monsters coming. Keep quiet.
Mm. Did you know those words? Or you just, it was some kind of thought?
It came. I don't know. I was a baby, yeah. I was under the age of two.
Yeah. And were monsters coming? Were monsters coming?
Well, I could hear the footsteps.
Okay, let's go back to and talk about these other cognizers. So we were on the correct assumers. Yeah. So it's a knower that does not get at an object with respect to which superimpositions have been eliminated although it adheres one pointedly to the phenomena, which is its principal object of engagement, is the definition of a correct assumer. Okay? So it's a knower that doesn't get at an object in the sense of it can't eliminate superimpositions, you know? It can't completely ascertain and can't completely understand the object, even though it's adhering one pointedly to it, and it's going in the right direction. Okay? So they say there's three types of, when correct assumers are divided, there's three. One without reason, one without ascertaining the reason, and the third is depending on a facsimile of a reason. And then they have another text, they divide it differently, okay, but in any case. So an illustration of a correct assumer without a reason is a mind that thinks sound is impermanent without any reason at all. We have lots of those, don't we? Yeah? Kind of. This is a dumb thing. Why? I don't know. Well, yeah, because it is. Or, you know, I want to do this. Why? Or, you know.
You said this to me. Why are you unhappy?
Yeah, yeah, why are you unhappy? Oh, yeah. Why do you think you know, the how do you say it? Sequestration? This thing that's going to happen tomorrow because they haven't figured out all the Republicans and Democrats haven't gotten together and done something. Remember when we were at the Kala Chakra and they were going in this big budget thing. So, and then they, you know, made some kind of compromise, and then they said that, you know, they laid out some cuts to domestic programs and cuts to defense and that were so drastic and horrible that they thought that the Democrats won't like this part, the Republicans won't like this part, so then they'll come together and they'll come up with some reasonable budget. Well, they haven't. So tomorrow all these cuts are going into effect across the board in a totally, like, crazy way.
Oh, my God.
Completely crazy. So, you know, so then they're saying, well, there's going to be disruption in air traffic. Yeah, because they're going to have to, what is it, that a lot of government employees in the next 2 months are going to have to take, no, in the next 6 months are going to have to take 22 furlough days without payment, you know, without wage. I think it was in 6 months, it was 22 days, something like that. But anyway, you know, they're going to furlough all these people without paying them anything, and they're doing government jobs, so government services like air traffic control and the TSA at the airport and meat inspection and all this stuff, you know, border patrol and, you know, some educational programs and, you know, all these things are just going to, the budget's going to get cut. So, you know, so then you have this mind that says, you know, well, I think, you know, the station, whatever, I can't say it, but I'll say sequester, but hopefully, you know what I mean, that is, you know, is going to cause all this damage. Yeah. Why? You know, so then you have some reasons for it. Yeah. So we don't know yet if those are correct reasons. Yeah. Because, I mean, there's without a reason, so it's not, some people are not saying without a reason, but without ascertaining the reason. So they could have the right reason, but maybe they don't fully understand it, like me. Or they could have a facsimile of a reason, you know, saying it's going to, you know, it, the sequester is a bad idea because, you know,
Europe's economy will.
Yeah, right, or, you know, some reason that doesn't relate to it. Or you could have a wrong reason, yeah, kind of, you know, but of course, you know, you come to the right conclusion, but your reason for having it is wrong. Yeah. So we don't know any of these things, all these forecasts that people are making, you know. Are they correct assumptions? Some people are saying, well, actually, it's quite good. You know, now a lot of the extra spending at the Pentagon is going to get cut out. Because the Pentagon budget is going to get cut, you know. And then the Republicans are saying, oh, a lot of these, you know, domestic programs that aren't so important, they'll get cut. And we're going to have real, real, you know, we're really going to work on the budget now and balance the American budget and stop cut spending. So now there's some people say, oh, well, it's good. So, you know, what is a correct assumption in this whole mishmash in the newspaper? We don't know, do we? And we don't know, there's probably some correct assumptions. We're not sure which ones there are. But we don't know if they have a reason behind them or if they have a good reason but it's not being ascertained, or if they have an irrelevant reason, a facsimile of a reason. Yeah, it's like saying... I'll come to the example here. Let's keep going. But I just was thinking, you know, that's kind of this whole thing of what's going on the national scene is kind of like that. And you know, we don't really know what kind of, cognizer it is right now. We'll only know after the fact. But it's completely crazy. You know, it's like anyway, I won't get on my high horse about the government. okay, so sound is impermanent without any reason at all. Okay, so the sequester is a good idea, the sequester is a bad idea, no reason. Okay, an illustration of a correct assumer without ascertaining the reason is a mind which thinks sound is impermanent based on the sign of being a product, but without having ascertained that sound is a product and that whatever is a product is necessarily impermanent. So sound is impermanent, you got the correct assumption. Okay. Because it's a product, that's a good reason. But you don't really understand the reason. You don't understand that, oh yeah, sound is a product, so there's the presence of the reason in the subject. And you don't understand the pervasion. Oh, if it's a product, then it's got to be impermanent. Okay? So you're saying it, but you don't grok it. Yeah? So this could be the same thing with a lot of the sequester. We don't really know what the correct assumption is. We won't know it until later. Yeah? And the people who are saying, you know, all these different things... you know, to what extent they ascertain, you know, they have reasons for this, but to what extent they ascertain those reasons and to what extent those reasons are correct reasons, we're not going to know until later. Yeah? It's quite interesting, isn't it? Yeah? All these people making all the predictions. We don't really know. And then... an illustration of a correct assumer depending on a facsimile of a reason is a mind that thinks sound is impermanent from the sign of being an object of comprehension. Okay? So it's like if I said sound is impermanent because it's a phenomena. Okay? Well, it's true sound is impermanent. Yeah. Does making it, and it's true sound is a phenomena. But does the fact that it's a phenomena mean it's impermanent?
No.
Okay. So it's called a facsimile of a reason. Yeah. The reason's kind of irrelevant, isn't it? That's an irrelevant thing. Or it could be, you know, sound is impermanent because, you know, the violets are blue. Yeah. Okay. Uh-huh.
Superimpositions mean this.
It means that you can actually ascertain what the object is clearly.
Without,
you know,
adding on anything?
Yeah, without adding on something, without confusing what the object is. You know, because so, an inference can, you know, can really ascertain the object in a correct way, in such a way that, you know, they say superimposition is being eliminated, in the sense that if you say, okay, on that hill over there, there is fire because there's smoke, that's something that's a reliable inference. And if somebody came along and said, oh, there, you know, yeah, there's smoke, but there's no fire, yeah, you're not going to change your mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you've been able to eliminate mm-hmm. any kind of, you know, wrong view about that. Mm-hmm. Okay? But a correct assumer isn't able to do that. And that's why, we can notice, we hear something and we say, oh yeah, that makes sense. And then somebody else tells us something else that's the opposite, and we go, oh yeah, that makes sense. Yeah? You ever notice that? And then a third person comes along and tells you something else about the same thing, and oh, that's the right thing. So those minds that are knowing those things haven't been able to eliminate superimposition. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because all somebody you need to do is somebody else comes along and tells you something and you believe the new thing. Mm-hmm. Okay? So I remember when we were studying Majjhimika Avatara with Geshe Sonam Rinchen, and, you know, when he wasn't telling us that's because you haven't identified the object of negation, then he would say, oh, you know, because we would be studying these other philosophies that the Madhyamaka would refute. And we'd go, who in their right mind would believe these other philosophies? This is so ridiculous, you know, like one of the Samkhya philosophy or something. Or, you know. And he would say, look, you know, if one of the people who believe in this came and taught you, you would become a Samkhya. Because they have reasons for what they believe, and you haven't really understood your reasons for believing what you believe. Yeah? So, kind of put us in our place. Samkhya doesn't make sense. Well, you know, listen to one of them speak. And, I mean, this is why we see, you know, people will come here and it's like, oh, yeah, Buddhism makes sense. And the next thing we hear, they're into some other philosophy or some other religion or some other practice. Or somebody says, I want to do this with my life, definitely, you know. And then a few months later they want to do something else. Yeah. So it's... You're laughing. So it's because our mind, our understanding isn't stable about things. We haven't really ascertained things. Yeah. So we might think, oh, I have an inference. No. No. Okay. So similarly, Sakya Pandita's Treasury of Reasoning says, correct assumers are not more than three. One, not depending on a sign. Being only an assertion, it can turn into doubt. Okay, so you don't have any reason. Yeah. I don't eat, you know, pickles. Why? No reason. Yeah. I don't like them. Why don't you like them? You know? Okay. So that can turn into doubt quite easily. Yeah. And you see, lots of times, you know, we make some statement, you know, I feel this way, or I want this. And then somebody says, why? And then we go, if we're smart, then we go, well, that's a good question. Yeah? You know, well, why am I so stuck on this? Maybe I should question it. Of course, if it's something that it's a good, you know, we have a correct cognizer of something, you know, we have a correct assumption, and then somebody comes along and says, why? And then we go, oh, yeah, well, you know, maybe there is God and all these kind of things, and that's not so good, but, okay. Then two, depending on a correct sign, in other words, it's a correct sign, but you haven't really ascertained it and understood it. And three, depending on a facsimile of a sign. Okay, so that's correct assumers. Anything in here?
What about the last paragraph, though?
Yeah, that's what I meant when they were talking about it. It makes it sound like,
yeah,
you know,
everything's included, but maybe not.
But maybe not. Yeah, and that's because, you know, they would, if you eliminate experience. Well, there's a lot of things that we know by experience, like the meditative stabilization on ugliness, you know, on the foulness. When you meditate on the body as foul and you get some kind of experience of that, yeah. Well, it's not, you know, what is it exactly?
Yeah, can't really put it in the inference category.
Yeah. Yeah. And then if you said, positing a correct assumption as a determinative knower that without depending on either experience or a correct sign. Okay? So it sounds like if you rely on experience and a correct sign, then you can, or a correct sign, then you can fit everything into correct assumers. But that doesn't, I don't know. That sounds strange. Yeah, to me it sounds strange to say a meditative stabilization on the foulness is a correct assumer. Yeah. Anyway, so that's the way I take it. Okay? Okay. Well, we didn't, again, get as far as I wanted to, but at least we did one thing. Okay. Any questions about? Yeah.
I'm trying to think how you would put this into what utility it would have, kind of.
Oh.
So
mm-hmm.
It seems like if you work on or understand or identify kind of correct assumer, then if you fine-tune that and get really clear and stable with it, then it turns into inferential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's its
kind
of the base to build that.
Right, right. You know, and actually when they talk about, let's say, apprehending subtle impermanence or apprehending emptiness, then we start out with a wrong consciousness. Mm-hmm. Then we hear teachings about emptiness and we go from that into doubt. Then we think about it some more and we go to a correct assumer. Oh yeah, things are empty because they're, you know, dependent arising. We kind of get it, but, you know, if somebody else came along and, you know, told us something else, we would probably go with the other thing. But then it's still a correct assumer, so we're making progress. But then we still keep contemplating that and reviewing it and really meditating on the syllogism. And then we get to the point where it becomes an inference. And then we keep meditating on some more, because especially with single-pointedness, because with the inference we're perceiving emptiness through the veil of a conceptual appearance, and then from inference it'll go to a direct perceiver of emptiness. So that's actually kind of the purpose for teaching all these things. Mm-hmm. So it is helpful for us if we can identify, you know, when is this, you know, what I say I know something, but to what extent do I know it really? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I spent one session, I didn't know if I was wasting it, but I spent one session starting to try to apply the syllogism reasoning to the longer points that I thought I knew.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, I have a prestige in life because I've been born in time of Buddha, or a time when a Buddha has come and taught. You know, I'm mm-hmm. just looking at that statement and, like, how much have I analyzed mm-hmm. the reason?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so for me it was interesting. I didn't get much past, I didn't even get way to the 9 points, but trying to take them apart, even little tiny point by little point, and looking at it, and trying to make a syllogism out of it,
mm-hmm.
it showed me how, not very deep.
Yeah.
My acceptance, absolute acceptance, but really if I analyzed it.
Yeah.
Well, do I believe this reason even? I mean,
right.
Yeah,
and is this reason true?
Yeah. Yeah,
it's
useful.
Yeah, very, very useful.
This paper I've been reading by Daniel Perdue
uh-huh.
talks about syllogisms.
Uh-huh.
And I think this thing he explains is helpful, that he says that you actually are building on reasoning that you already have, so that in an actual... The way he explains a syllogism, the reason is something you've already established in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're using the predicate to prove something that you haven't. Mm-hmm. So he says, what's a valid...
No, the predicate is what you want to prove.
Right. Yeah, that's what you want to prove.
Mm-hmm.
You're basing it on a reason that you've already established in your mind. So he's saying that syllogisms are only valid for the person who's kind of inquiring. For
mm-hmm.
the person who's already established these things, they aren't even considered valid. They're valid for the person who's, like, asking the question. And so the question is what the thesis is. And they've already established the reason, and this is how you go forward. I think this is
I don't totally understand. Mm-hmm. What does he mean you've already established
the reason?
But the reason is product of causes.
Right. So in that one, what you've got is you've got a person who's trying to decide is sound impermanent, but they've already established in their mind that it's the product of causes. So
okay. If they've established sound is a product of causes, then they've already established the presence of the reason in the subject.
Right. That's kind of how he's saying this works.
Mm-hmm.
And then what makes sense to me about this is, I think it's useful it's been useful to set these up no matter how they go. But I can see where there's this case made that you're building on something you already know. I think about it in mm-hmm. terms of like what you were just asking, because the one I think about is rebirth.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, rebirth is a good example for this.
Mm-hmm.
When I set it up, I think there's reasons that I try to take the correct assumption, what the Dharma has. I try to take that as the correct assumption and then find ways to support it. So then what I've done over the years is come up with these reasons,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I can actually say I have a certain level of belief in.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have to, then I use that to build the next part, which is the predicate. What I'm trying to then prove to myself.
Mm-hmm.
Like it could be like, rebirth exists because, and I have a lot of reasons
mm-hmm.
that I have some faith in.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why it's a valid syllogism for me. But if you could say the same statement, like I could say, rebirth exists because one reason I give myself, over the millennia, every religion has posited something after death.
Mm-hmm.
Many, not all, but mm-hmm. many. And that's one of the things that I use to shore it up, that it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so for me, that works. It's valid because I have some faith in the reason.
Mm-hmm.
For another person, because I had this discussion with Ken, it was mm-hmm. so interesting. We took the same information, and then we came to completely opposite conclusions
mm-hmm.
because of the way we held the reasons.
Mm-hmm. But then what you can also do is look at the reason and question the reason and see if the reason is actually correct or not.
Yeah, because you could have reasons
that were wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Facsimile.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So, I mean, that's like if somebody said rebirth exists because... No, not that. But let's come up with something. Oh, yeah, I really love my girlfriend, and we must have known each other in past lives. Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but that's not a valid reason.
Right.
It's not a valid reason. So that person may use it to shore up their belief in rebirth, but they're not going to reach an inference by that reason, because the reason is baloney.
Especially if they break up.
Yeah.
What if they break up?
No, but like rebirth exists because, you know, I'm in love with this person, and so we must have known each other in previous lives. Yeah, and somebody may say, yeah, otherwise there's no other reason to explain why we hit it off right at the first time we set eyes on each other. The rebirth must have existed. We must have known each other in previous lives.
So that I agree. But what about the person who had awareness of their previous life, and they knew they had met that person?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say, you know, that would be valid.
The idea of rebirth exists because I've had a direct perception of my previous life.
Right. Yeah.
Well. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. So I mean, you always have to investigate the reason to see if it's true. Like in this one syllogism that they use, the first one in Nagarjuna is Karikas. You know, like the self is not produced, or you know, let's say the person is not produced, or the body, let's say, the body is not produced by self, other, both, or causelessly. Yeah? So to do that, you have to actually make sub things, you know, the body. The body is not, does not arise from self because, and then understand the whole thing there, and then the body doesn't arise from other because, and you have a reason. So you have to go through each of those different points.
I really am happy to have read this because to me it seems like it gives the process a direction. In a way.
Yeah.
That's
what I mean. Yeah. I mean, we're always
stepwise direction.
Yeah. I mean, we're all to make inferences. We have to have certain knowledge. Mm-hmm. It's not like sometimes the way they describe inferences is as if it's, you know, it's just perfect the way it is, and so you should just hear it and believe it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But actually, you have to understand some syllogisms. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to understand so many other things before that.
You have to be searching to want to understand it.
Yeah.
It's not like, I think it also answers what, you know, John Pell is bringing up, like, because this has always been something I've thought for years, that logic can get you into a lot of trouble. If you just follow logic, sometimes it can lead you down a lot of bad paths.
Yeah, a lot of times, because it's not real logic.
Yeah.
It's phony baloney. Yeah. So what we call logic isn't always logical. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so to actually understand something through a syllogism, I mean, you need to understand lots of other stuff, too. I mean, even somebody saying, you know, there's fire on that hill because there's smoke. You need to know what smoke is. You need to know what fire is. You need to know that if there's smoke, there's fire. You need to know how to identify smoke correctly and tell the difference between smoke and vapor.
Or like the time the guys were riding their cars out there and we thought there was a fire on the hillside. We had to get out the binoculars and look.
Oh, right,
they
yeah.
They were actually riding, making dust.
Yeah, right.
We
right.
thought there was a fire.
Yeah.
We called the fire guy.
Yeah, yeah. And it was, actually, I wanted to tell you a story of my wrong perception of the week. So, you know, I go and exercise in the community room, and if it's at a certain time in the afternoon, the deer are out by the block. And so I get used to seeing the deer there, and, you know, they're kind of my friends and everything. And one day I was looking out, and okay, there was a deer over here, but then there was something else moving by the block, and initially I said, oh, it's a deer. But then it was round in the back, and I thought, no, I wouldn't see round. You know, what is that? And then, you know, it kind of moved up, and I thought, maybe it's a bear. You know, because it was kind of had a big, it wasn't shaped like a deer, it was shaped more, you know. And then I realized it was wearing robes. My royal wrong consciousness for the week. Yeah, but when you're in you know, a bundled up in a jacket, a bulky jacket, you know, and you lift your hands, it's, you know, kind of, yeah. You know. Okay. So I think we better close. Okay, so keep thinking about these things this week. And really look at the different kinds of things. And you know, ask yourself, what kind of understanding is this? Yeah, I mean, even out on the building. You know, we were talking today. You were trying to get, you were looking at certain of the trusses, and, you know, where do they go? Yeah? And so we have to have a reason, you know, well, this truss must be here because da 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 da. And then to see if it was an actual inference or if the truss winds up in the other side of the hall. And, you know, and it wasn't even a correct assumer. So, yeah, so all these kinds of things, you know, we can use this process to look at.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all other hindrances, grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lhotse's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Angurana mandala kamiryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness, powerful tent and guest of generosity. May you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and non-violent actions in the the 10 directions, and especially Ashravastiavi in the west, Florida.